My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. We spend a lot of time on resentment. The book says it's number one offender. If you've noticed something, when we did the first three columns on the resentment list process, it was almost as if I took the position of the prosecuting attorney. And then from this was our course, through referring to our list again, I've had to take the position of the defense attorney. One place, I'm looking at it from my self-centered prosecuting point of view and judgment, and then I have to look at it from an other-centered point of view and put myself in their place and see it through their eyes. And that's where the shift, the change of perception comes, the 180-degree turn. And one of the great things that happens to me as a result, not only of doing this myself in my own fourth and fifth step, but then consequently over the years through listening to other fifth steps, is that I start to get that maybe what Einstein said was true when he said the great illusion of mankind is that there's more than one of us here. You listen to enough fifth steps, and you do enough inventories, and you know what you see? You see the same guy in different towns with different faces doing the same thing to different people. It's the same guy. It's never any different. I'm waiting for a different fifth step. I'm waiting. Sometimes I wish that it would be different. I wish somebody would come up with something new with, fluids and barnyard animals and jumper cables and Visqueen or something. But it's never anything that exciting or dramatic. It's just the same pathetic judgments and the same pathetic insecurities and fears and the same pathetic self-justified sexual gratification endeavors and excursions. It's the same stuff over and over and over and over. We're all the same. The Hindus, we were talking about the Hinduism at lunch a little bit. The Hindus have a story of creation that is marvelous. Unlike the Judeo-Christian story of creation where God created the heaven and the earth in 7 days, etc., the Hindus have their story of creation is called Maya, which means the great illusion. And their story is that God existed unto himself with nothing else for endless eons, for endlessness. And after eons of endlessness unto himself with nothing else, he became bored. So he created this cosmic game. And what the game was, he decided to break himself up into an infinite number of parts, give all the parts amnesia. And the game is, which parts are going to realize they're not separate first? And isn't the separation the illusion of the ego? That it comes from my judgment? My judgment, the greatest judgment, the biggest wrong I've ever had, is that my case is different. That I'm not like you. You wouldn't understand me. But the real truth is that in the realm of the spirit, and that's one of the things it's going to talk about later in the steps, that we are going to enter into the realm of the spirit. In the realm of the spirit, there is no separation. There is no separation. And the Hindus call that enlightenment. When you finally got it, that there is no separation between you and me and you and God. It's all the same. It's all the same. But the illusions of the ego and the defenses that we create the separation. I'll give you a little example of this. I want to go through the process of resentment real quickly with one resentment and to show you exactly how it works. And if you have a resentment that's unresolved, the best resentments to work this with are ones that are justified. They're the best ones to work it with. Okay. I'll tell you the story, the kind of the prelude to the resentment. When I was 6 years sober, I got married to a gal I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were married for 4.5 years. When we were married almost 3 years, maybe a little less than 3 years, we had a child, my daughter, Katie, who is the love of my life. We just had her 16th birthday party, and she's just a sweetheart. And we had Katie, and then about a year and a half, about a year after we had Katie, my wife came to me one day and told me that she wanted a divorce. And I'll tell you, one of the symptoms of my own particular self-centeredness when I'm in it is that I don't get it. If I'm fine, I think the world's fine. I don't pay attention. I don't get it if there's something wrong with you unless you tell me and wave a flag in my face. I'll just ignore it wrapped up in me, right? And I didn't think there was a problem in the marriage. Matter of fact, somebody would ask me, I'd say, oh, we got the perfect day, marriage is wonderful. Didn't even know until she asked me for a divorce. Then I got it. Okay, maybe there's a problem here. And I said, Jesus, really? What's wrong? Well, I'm just not happy. I just don't want to be. So I talked her out of the divorce. I said, let's go to some marriage counseling. And she agreed. She said, okay, we'll try the marriage counseling. We started entering into marriage counseling. And the guy, my first sponsor, who was my sponsor back then, had retired and he bought a bus. And he was on an extended 6 month to a year sabbatical, incommunicado, could not talk to him. He was traveling around the country in this bus. And he was somewhere in Kentucky or Washington, D.C. or somewhere on the East Coast at the time in this deal he was in. And so my confidant through all of this, the guy I started talking to, was a guy that I sponsored named Craig, who was sober at the time about 3 years. And he was also sort of one of my favorite pigeons that I sponsored. And him and I would, he was the guy that I would talk to about the marriage problems and about what was going on in counseling, etc. He was my confidant. Went to marriage counseling for a couple months. And one day, my wife comes up to me and she says, I don't want to do the marriage counseling anymore. I'm one out. And I said, okay. And I there was something wasn't happening in the marriage counseling. And no matter what would come up, she would say something. I'd say, okay, we can try that. And we'd try it, and nothing would be different. It was still a problem there. It was like, I didn't know what it was. And I just thought, well, maybe it's just meant to be. And we decided to get a divorce. And in Las Vegas, an uncontested divorce can happen quickly. I mean, like 10 days. It's quick. And we got a divorce on a Thursday. The papers were finalized. Friday, the next day, my wife and daughter moved in with Craig, my best friend, my sponsee, my confidant. And I find out that they had been sleeping together for over the last year of my marriage. And I didn't know about it. And I found out that everybody in AA knew about it except me. Now, here I am. I'm in my 11th year of sobriety. And you guys have been telling me for almost 11 years that there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment. Well, I got one now. And I can even get old timers in AA to agree with me. I got that ability, maybe some of you have it, walking into a room, 50 people, and just intuitively know who to go to that'll side with you. You know what I mean? That'll agree with you, that'll co-sign your crap. And it doesn't matter how long they're sober. And I'd find those guys sober 25, 30 years. I'd tell them my tale of woe, and they'd say things to me like, geez, Bob, and God, didn't you just buy her a new car? And I'd go, yes, I did. And the nail holes in my hands would open up from the cross a little bigger, you know, and it was hideous. It was awful. And I'm dying. And I tell you, if there was a short period of time, not very long, where I got some vindication and I got some mileage out of being a victim. You know, you do get a lot of attention after being really hurt. You know, you get a little bit of attention and you get that ego pump of feeling smugly superior. Well, I've never cheated on her, you know, that kind of crap. But I'll tell you, even though you get a little bit of ego gratification from that, If you're an alcoholic of my type, you start to get real sick of spirit right in here, real sick. And it's forcing me into my head, and I'm going crazy. And I can't get rid of it. And I sat down with this book, and I was going to try to do the resentment inventory, and I was too close. I couldn't do it yet. And I'd go to meetings, and I would talk about it, meetings, and people would line up to give me advice. Oh, and it was hideous. One guy said to me, "Well, Bob, just don't think about it." I thought, okay, how do you do that? I mean, how do you stop thinking about something you can't stop thinking about? One guy said to me, "Well, if you believed in God, it wouldn't be a problem." I thought, oh, man, what are you talking? I wanted to hit him. I believe in God, but it's a problem. And God was very, very merciful to me. Thank God that I had a high level of involvement in AA, and all of a sudden, it was funny how God works. All of a sudden, I got more guys asking me to sponsor them with various lengths of sobriety that are going through divorces and relationship breakups. I mean, there are waves of them are coming, and I'd fill my car up with a bunch of them. And we'd drive to the meeting, go to the meeting. We'd be the depressed section of the meeting, you know. You'd almost hear the chairman tell the secretaries. The secretaries tell the chairman, "Don't call on them, you know. They'll talk about that stuff." And these guys relieved me of the bondage of self. They gave me islands in my day where I would get me off of me a little bit. I remember just being insane. I just came from dropping my daughter off at the house where they lived all together and watched them wave goodbye as I drove away alone. My daughter and him and her standing there, and I'm dying inside. And I'm dying. And I drove over to pick up this guy that I'm sponsoring as an idiot, and I don't want to pick him up. And he gets in the car. And he's sitting next to me in the car, and he starts crying because he can't see his kids and he hasn't seen them in 2 years. And another birthday for his one daughter just went by. And I got out of myself a little bit, you know. And those islands of relief from me bought me enough time to eventually go back and do this process. And I put both their names down, column number one. Column number two, what they did, the lies, the infidelity, the cheating, the whole deal. Column number three, what was hurt, threatened, affected, or interfered with, everything. My pride was devastated. My ambitions, my pocketbook, my emotional and material security, my relationships in AA, my sex relations, everything was threatened. Everything was hurt. Everything was affected. Nothing was left untouched. And then it says this was our course. And it's asking me to do something that was very hard to do. I had to look at the situation through their eyes. How would they be seeing it if they were telling their sponsor about it? If they were honest with themselves about what happened, what would they be saying to themselves or to someone else? The book says this was our course. We must realize, I had to get it, that though I didn't like the symptoms of their sickness and how they affected me, that they were like me, spiritually sick. And I said that prayer. And I'll tell you what I started to get a sense of what it must have been like to be my ex-wife in that marriage. I started to understand what it would have been like to be a gal who grew up in an alcoholic home, not as I did. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. An alcoholic home that by the time she entered into sobriety, she had developed certain defense mechanisms that rendered her absolutely incapable of confrontation. Absolutely incapable of being dissatisfied and telling someone about it because she was too afraid of their rejection. And she marries a guy who's Mr. AA, who goes to a lot of meetings, and he's got this opportunity in business to build this business, but he's got to, all of a sudden, after they're married for a little while, he's got to work 70 hours a week to build this business which was a life, once in a lifetime opportunity. But between, she put her whole life around a guy, and in short order, a guy that really wasn't there very much. A guy that worked 70 hours a week and then did AA commitments to keep his own sanity and was gone most of the time. And I started to get a sense, see, she didn't have the involvement in a job or a business. She didn't work. She didn't have the life that filled her up that I had. I was the life that she turned to fill up, and I ain't there. And when I started to really get it, where she was coming from, and really understand and realize inside myself the desolation and the loneliness that she must have experienced in that marriage, and her trappedness, because she didn't have the skills to get out of it. She didn't have the skills to get involved in a lot of stuff and fill her life up. She didn't have the skills to even tell me she was dissatisfied. Everything was fine all the time. And I pictured myself in that trap. And when I really got it, I thought to myself, my God, how did she last as long as she did? I would have had an affair year before she did. And I would have felt awful about doing it. And Karen felt awful about doing it. She suffered tremendous from her behavior, from that action. She really did. And I started to look at the last part. Where was I selfish, dishonest, resentful, afraid, self-seeking? And you know what I saw that was really, when I went through these questions, where was I selfish? The whole thing was about me. I am so wrapped up in myself, in my little plans and designs, that I never once stopped to consider what's going on with her. I never got other-centered enough to wonder how full her life is, because mine was fine, thank you. I never got other-centered enough to ever wonder, you know, is this plan of mine to work 70 hours a week and do all this AA and leaving you here by yourself, is that okay for you? I never even asked. I just had the blinders on of selfishness. This is my little plans and designs. And where was I dishonest? Oh, God. You know, I lied to myself about a lot of stuff. I had a lot of justifications. I remember one of them was, you know, even when I started to look at some of this stuff, I started saying, yeah, but I had to do all that. I mean, my God, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have this business. I mean, I'd been stupid not to do it, and I had to work 70 hours a week, and that was true. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I did have to work, I had probably 60 anyway, but I'm a little over-the-top obsessive guy, and I became a little bit of a workaholic. And that's all true. And it was also true that I, because of that high involvement level and at work and having a wife and kids and everything, I had to do AA or go crazy. That's all true. But there's a deeper truth. And the deeper truth is, even though there is some element of validity in those justifications, those things were also very convenient. Because my big secret is I don't know how to do intimacy. My big secret is after about 6 or 8 months in a relationship, I've told you all the funny stories about my childhood. We've done all the little conversation stuff. Now all of a sudden there's dead air and a living day-by-day adventure with another human being I've never had and didn't know how to do. I didn't know how to grow together with someone. I didn't know how to integrate myself in a partnership in someone else's life. And it was an awkward, when the stories were over and the shine of everything wore off, there was an emptiness in there and a feeling of inadequacy. And so I got real, it was very convenient to get busy because I didn't know what else to do. And guys like me, when the vacancy's on you, one way to get away from it is to stay busy. So I worked 70 hours a week. And I had AA commitments, and I sponsored guys, and I was on committees, and I was all that stuff. Where was I dishonest? And I made this illusion in my mind of what a great husband I was. Such a bunch of crap. I was great in the fact that I was a good provider and I never cheated on her, but in the real day-to-day things that really matter, I sucked. I was terrible. On the matters of the heart, the things that really have substance in a relationship, I was terrible. I'd never grown up. Was I terrible because I was a bad guy? No, I just never learned how to do that stuff. As if I don't know what it is about me. I won't ask for help in an area because I think I should know. You know, I should know. I don't want to look like I don't know. I didn't know. Where was I self-seeking? It was all about me and trying to fill my holes, trying to keep everything juggled and in place. And where was I frightened? Oh my God, I was scared to death. I remember a night my wife was pregnant and my daughter was coming pretty soon. I remember a night when I was so overcome with anxiety and fear, I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I remember getting in my car and driving up into Utah and drove hundreds of miles. And like I didn't ever want to come back. I was scared to death. I was a guy who never even could take care of myself. And now I had a wife and a child on the way. And I was overwhelmed. It was just too big. It was too much for me. You see, I was back in the driver's seat. God was not running my life. Somehow it got to be back in my care. If I'd have trusted God, I'd just been able to show up for the next thing. But I had it right here on me. And it was overwhelming. I was scared to death. Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where was I to blame? I'll tell you something that became real clear to me. Entering into that marriage, if I would have went to a major university and hired every genius, every professor that was expert in the areas of psychology and sociology, and I brought them together in a big conference room, and I gave them the psychological profiles of the gal I was going to marry and tell them everything about her and let them interview them, and then said to them, in light of all of this information, here's a gal that's faithful, good-natured, loving, kind, monogamous. Can you gentlemen come up with a game plan that I can implement over the next couple years that would make her cheat on me? Can you come up with something like that? I'm telling you, whatever they would have come up with wouldn't have been as more effective than what I did. See, I'm the guy. Sometimes people hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in that position to be hurt. I'm the guy. And I was able to do the same thing for him. He was actually easier. She was the harder stretch for me. Because the minute I started to put myself in his position, it was like, oh yeah. I remember him one time saying to me, he got sober and he was a lonely guy and he didn't do very well with women and he really wanted a relationship. And he said to me one time, he said, God, if I could just someday have what you have with Karen. I didn't think he meant specifically. I thought he meant in a general way, right? But what I was able to do, this was our course with him. And I mean, he had her on a pedestal of like my sponsor's wife, and she's young and beautiful and all this, and she's sober a long time, longer than him, and all this other stuff. And then knowing what it's like to be a guy, I know as a guy, and I know what happened, the details in their deal was she initiated it all out of her resentment towards me because she was lonely and pissed because I was gone. And I know as a guy, there have been times in my life where I have had the most noble, honorable intentions, very, really good of heart, and have been with a gal and absolutely had made up my mind, this is on the square here, there's nothing going to happen here, we're just going to be friends and this is just the way it is. And a gal can do certain things and touch me in a certain way where I will be frantically looking for that resolve. I know it was here a minute ago. Where did that go? I mean, and it's gone. And I know that about me. I know that's why I will avoid situations where I'm liable to do something that later I'm going to think, God, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Not because I'm such a great guy. I've learned, if nothing else, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned to protect Bob from Bob. And so I could see him very easily and myself and him very easily. And I came out the back side of that and I realized I owed both of them a tremendous amends. And I tell you what happened when I made the amends to her. It was three parts. The first part, I said something to her that I think in the bottom of her soul she wanted to hear. I told her how sorry I was for not being there for her. And more importantly, I told her that I got it. I understood what she went through. And I understood exactly how what happened happened. And I think she'd wanted to hear me. She wanted me to get that so bad. And there was a healing not only in me as a result of that amends, but in her. And we've become really good friends. And I did the same thing with him. And part of my amends to him and to her is that I went around Alcoholics Anonymous like an idiot for about 6 months. Every time they'd let me share at a meeting, I would tell my tale of woe, justifying sharing it at meetings that I need to get this off my chest. And no, that's a bunch of crap. You know what I was really doing? I wanted everybody in the meeting to think of them as badly as I did. I wanted everybody that would listen to me to hate them the way I hated them. And I'll tell you something, I did a lot of harm to them. And I harmed their reputation because I didn't tell the whole truth. I told my self-centered, judgmental, vindictive version of it. And part of the amends to them was to go around and tell the truth. And the truth was that they didn't do anything that I wouldn't have done if somebody had put me in the position I put them in. That they weren't bad guys. They were people that were just like me. And that I could have easily done the same thing that they did. And what a tremendous healing that occurred as a result of this part of the book. See, I came out the other side and I'm free. I sponsor him. I sponsored him now for a long time. There was about a couple year period where I didn't. And he was lost. He almost died as a result of that. He had a hard time taking himself off the hook. And I had a tremendous amends to make to him. Because I bad-wrapped him and I hurt his reputation. I tried to stab him in the back by slander and gossip and Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted everybody to... You know what I really secretly wanted? I wanted everybody to hate him and ostracize him from AA so he would have to die of alcoholism. All right? Pretty pathetic. And I had to go make amends to him. He's an outstanding member of my home group. He's one of the best guys I sponsor today. And I'll tell you what else he is. Him and Karen got married after that, and it's pretty hard to maintain a relationship when you start like that. And they eventually got divorced, and I'll tell you, a funny thing happened. I'd have never guessed. I spent 6 months working with both of them, trying to help them to save their marriage. Isn't that a bizarre thing? Isn't that a bizarre thing? You know why I did it? I really believed in my heart they were good for each other. They were much better together than her and I ever were. And you know what else? He was an incredible stepfather to my daughter and still is. I introduce him to people as my ex, my ex-husband-in-law. And we just were at my daughter's birthday and we're just palling it up and crying and laughing and having a good time. And even the fact that they're divorced, he's still part of my daughter's life. He's a good guy. We've sat, the three of us, in ball games and cheered my daughter on and booed the other team. And it's a great thing. There's a tremendous power in this thing called resentment. And I'll tell you, if you're sitting here and all you've ever done is tell somebody your life story, you've missed a lot of this, really. I would highly recommend going back and following this procedure and finding someone else that can help you do it. Page 67, the second part, we're going to kind of go through fear and sex quickly. I don't like to do sex quickly, but it's just what we'll do. It says, bottom of page 67, it says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Every resentment I ever had involved fear, without exception. It is impossible to be angry without being threatened. You can't do it. And yet, I was pathological in my life to the point where I was so afraid of being afraid, I developed certain defense mechanisms that when I was threatened, I jumped right to rage because I don't even want to admit to myself that I'm scared. I just automatically, some of the worst fights I've been in my life, some of the worst violence that I've participated in, some of the most hideous stuff I've ever done has not been because I was tough. It's because I was scared to death. And I was so afraid of being weak and letting anybody ever know that I was afraid, I developed, it cultivated this defense mechanism of rage and violence and fear. So you'd never know what a pathetic weakling, scared weakling I am. I did that in county jails. I'd put on that grill outfit and act like a tough guy. I did it when I ran the streets. I did it. And I was afraid. And I didn't want to be afraid. And I have this fundamental basic fear of being afraid. I think somewhere as a young child, I came to the conclusion that if you're afraid, you're vulnerable, you're weak, people can run over you, they can take advantage of you, you're less than human, there's something wrong with you if you're afraid. Never show your fear. Never be afraid. And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm in my between 4 and 5 years of sobriety, and I'm starting to do my first real inventory out of the book. And I get through the resentment section, and I did pretty good with that. Didn't come too difficult. But I got to the fear section, and I'm blocked. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and I got this yellow legal pad, and I got fear written across the top of it. And I'm trying to figure out something to put down on this paper, and I'm coming up blank. I'm thinking, man, I can't think of anything I'm afraid of. I don't really feel afraid of anything. And the thought went through my mind, well, maybe, oh God, I'm sober a few years now. Maybe AA works. You know, maybe I just don't have any fear anymore. And I went to a late night meeting, and there was a guy there sober a long time, and I grabbed him. I said, you know, I'm doing this inventory, and I just finished my resentment section. I started the fear thing, and I don't have any fears. I said, you know, I don't think I have any fears anymore. He looked at me and said, really? I said, yeah, I don't think I have any fears. He said, can I ask you some questions? I said, yeah, sure. He said, are you afraid of large, angry, barking dogs? Well, yeah. He said, oh, good. Put that down. That's good, good. Put that down. How about rattlesnakes? Well, yeah. Black widow spiders? Yeah. Are you afraid of being embarrassed? Yeah. Are you sometimes afraid of what people think of you? Yeah. Are you afraid of growing old alone? Yeah. Are you afraid no one will ever really love you? Yeah. Are you afraid of being sick and not being able to take care of yourself? Yeah. Are you afraid that God's going to find out what a crap head you are and pull his grace away from you? Yeah. Are you afraid of success and all the responsibilities that come with it? Yeah. Are you afraid of failure? Yeah. Are you afraid of stuff from your past catching up with you? Yeah. Are there people that you're afraid to face that you haven't seen for years? Yeah. Are you afraid of homosexuality? Yeah. It's in county jails. Are you afraid of cancer? Oh, jeez. Yeah, I had cancer every other day and when I was new. I could feel brain tumors growing in my head. I remember one time I got up in the morning and something was wrong with my leg and I couldn't. It was screwed up. And I knew it was bone cancer. I knew it. And I went down to the hospital and I waited in the waiting room for an hour and a half and to get x-rays and stuff. And I know it's cancer, bone cancer. And I'm in the waiting room and I'm doing my deathbed speeches. I'm imagining what's going to happen in the last stages when I'm in the cancer ward and the people from AA come in to see me and I'm giving my spiritual last talk. And it's wonderful too. It's really wonderful. And I get it all figured out and then the people I'm going to let them know how they weren't quite right to me and, you know, in life and how they're going to feel bad when they find out I was dying and they treated me right. And all that crap. And they get the x-rays and the doctor finally sees me and he says, there's nothing wrong with your leg. I think you slept on it funny or something. And I want a second opinion. You sure? I don't want to be wrong about my fears. I would rather be right and dying of cancer, but right. I like to be right. Than to be wrong and free and go home and live a normal life. Isn't that bizarre? That I'd want to be that right about something I get convinced of. And I found that I was afraid of a lot. It says it's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. I'm sitting at that kitchen table looking for fear, and I come up blank because I'm like a fish looking for water. It is the driving, consuming, motivating force in my life, and I've just adjusted to it. As Dr. Silkworth says, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I just have assumed that it's normal to worry about everything. I think it's normal to live with an edge of apprehension and anxiety in your life. I think it's normal to have a head that spins occasionally about stuff. I think it's normal to have 30 conversations with someone before you actually go talk to them. You know, I think all of that's normal. I've just adjusted to being driven by fear. It's what causes me to dress the way I dress, work the way I work, work where I work. Do the things I do with money, live where I live, drive what I drive, talk the way I talk. It's the driving, motivating force in my life, and I can't see it because I've adjusted to the journey. Fabric of my existence shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Psychologists call that self-fulfilling prophecies. And what happens in my life over and over again, I will get a fear that I will secretly believe. And I will believe in this fear in the face of all kinds of opinions from other people. Not going to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. I believe the fear. And then because of an inert inability to manage my own life, I start to defend myself against the fear. And inevitably, I didn't have much self-esteem, really. I didn't have a lot going for me. I was working at a kind of a minimal little job. And I was going to AA, and I was being the best Bob I could be. I was trying to chip away at my amends. And I met this girl and became obsessed with her. And I was so afraid from the gate that she was going to leave me and dump me. I was so afraid that she was going to find somebody that had more going on than I did, and I'd get dumped. And what happened is that I must have believed that fear so much that fear drove me to become the possessive, controlling, smothering guy she couldn't live with. that fear drove me to be the nutcase that would drive by her apartment in the middle of the night looking for guys' cars. It drove me to be the nutcase that would watch her in meetings to make see if she's talking to any guys. She said to me one time, "You're always looking at me." "What do you mean I'm always looking at you? I'm protecting my investment here." She said to me one time, "You're smothering me." "What do you mean? What? I don't get it. I don't get it." And what happened, and I didn't realize this until down the road further when I got in a relationship with someone who was doing that to me. And then I got it. And I had never been in that spot again in my life. I'd beat it out of me. I'd never been in that spot again. And what I had done is I had literally drove her out of my life. And I remember the day she left and she went with this other guy and they went off to, to his townhouse. I remember the day. There was a little voice in the back of my head that said, "See? You were right. I like being right. I like being right. Even if it means I'm broken, laying in the gutter, dying, at least I was right." You know what I mean? I make that stuff come true. Had a job one time. My dad helped me get this job. Needed a job badly. My dad knew this guy who owned this company that it was an environmental engineering outfit. And this was back in the day when environmental engineering was cutting edge stuff. There was all of a sudden government mandates in place for every industry to clean up their air pollution, to test their smokestacks, to test their water coming out of the factories back east. And back east is just tons of factories. And this company was on the cutting edge. And the guy who owned the company hired me and gave me a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that if I stayed there, he would teach me how to become an environmental engineer and walk me through the process. And without ever finishing college, I could actually have gotten certified to work for his company as an environmental engineer. I would have been on the ground floor. Tremendous opportunity. But the problem is he gave it to a person with the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And I went there afraid. And I went there afraid that I didn't measure up. I went there afraid that the people there were talking about me, that they were saying things like, "Look at him. The only reason he's here is his father knows the owner. He wasn't for that. We'd never have someone like him here." Now, nobody's saying that. But I'm imagining I got that fear that they're doing that. I got that fear of not being accepted by them. I got that fear that they're going to reject me. And what happened is that fear drove on me and affected my attitude and my interaction with those people to push me to become controlling and defensive and on the muscle with them and so serious that one day they're calling me to the office and they're saying to me, "Bob, you know, you're a hard worker, but we're going to have to let you go. Because for some reason, Bob, you're not a team player." And I made the fear come true. I made it come true. And I could tell you, I could go on and on with examples of how I make my fears come true. Part of the exact nature of my wrongs is not only was I wrong in my judgments about other people and my resentments, my fears are really judgments about my own life that I make, and I believe them. When it says in the book that we think it should be classed with stealing, it robs me of my very life. I sat with a guy that was dying of cancer one time, and he was sober about 30-some years, and he was an old guy, and he probably only had about a year left to go, and he said to me something I never forgot. He said, "You know, when you get to this point in your life, and you're on the home stretch, and you look back over your life, it's not the things that you did wrong that you regret. It's the things you were afraid to try. And the fear will steal you, will rob you of your very life." See, I'm the kind of guy that says, somebody says to me in early sobriety, "Do you want to try snow skiing? You'd really like it." "No, I wouldn't like that. Never did it. How do I know? I'm afraid. I'm afraid of trying it and looking dumb." Somebody said to me, "Boy, you got to try scuba diving. I think you'd really like that." "I wouldn't like that. I know. See, I just know stuff, you know. What was afraid? I was afraid. Why don't you try bowling, golf? Why don't you try jogging? Why don't you try working out? Why don't you try? Why don't you try motorcycles? Didn't you used to ride when before you got so screwed up on the drug? Nah, I don't like that. I wouldn't like that anymore. So I never tried nothing. I was sober 10 years before I had a core and a trust enough in God to be able to show up in life and try some stuff like that. And really, it didn't matter whether I looked like a dummy or not. And to my amazement, I loved to ski. I loved it. I was so wrong in that judgment. I believed with everything in me. I wouldn't like it. Oh, no, it's not going to be a bad experience for me. I believed that about motorcycles. I believed it about scuba diving. I believed it about some people that I just was so afraid they wouldn't like me that I never tried to get next to them. I have a guy that I sponsored just recently. He said to me, he's enthralled with this girl. And he says, God, I can't stop thinking about her. I said, is she single? Yeah. Ask her out. Oh, no. No, I'm not going to ask her. Ask her out. No. I said, why not? Ask her out. He said, she'll say no. I said, let me get this straight. If she says no, that means you're not going to go out with her, right? He said, yeah. I said, are you going out with her now? He says, no. I said, what the hell's the difference? Ask her to go out. Right? What's the difference? You've already she can't reject you. You're too quick for her. You've already done it. You're too quick for her. And he asked her out, and now they're riding off into the sunset for a while anyway. Who knows in AA, you know? And he came to me. He said, she said yes. What'd you think she was going to say? She's going to say what your head says. She's going to look at you and go, what? Me? Go out with a pathetic, useless piece of human flesh like you? I said, nobody thinks about you the way you do. Nobody believes the crap about you that you do. So I had him put on his mirror. I got this from my friend Keith. Keith told me, his sponsor made him do it. I said, had him put on the mirror, Luther, your head is wrong, and read that every day. You're wrong. So what do? We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So I'm making a list. We ask ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. I cannot protect myself from the things I'm afraid of by managing well. As a matter of fact, a lot of times I make them come true. And even if I don't make them come true, I pay the dues that I would have paid if they'd have come true. I pay them 1,000 times in my mind over and over and over and over again. I make a mistake, I pay the price once. I never try, and I'm faced with the opportunity, and I pay the price over and over and over and over again. Buy in here. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve our fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Do we think there is a better way? We think so, for we are now on a different basis. Step 3, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. The problem, the reason self-reliance fails me is that I do not have the capacity to carry my own life. It's too big. For me to take the responsibility of wresting happiness and satisfaction out of this world and defending myself against the things that seem to be threatening, it's more than I can handle. That's why it feels like when you're That's why we feel often like we're going to have a nervous breakdown. That's why alcohol, for those of us that insist upon playing God, is so convenient, because it's a pressure valve. When we're just up to here with running the universe, we can go get drunk and go... It relieves the pressure. But those of us that can't drink anymore, we must find a better way. It says we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. I had a nervous breakdown several years before I got sober, and I had it sober. It was the last time I ever went to my parents' house. I came off a drunk that was hideous. In one drunk, I'd reduced my life to nothing, lost everything. I was homeless. It was the last time I was allowed in their house, and I could stay there on the condition I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I went crazy. And I had eventually had a nervous breakdown. And you know what it was like? When I stopped drinking, all of a sudden the whole world is on my shoulders. And when you're the center, there's a lot of crap to worry about. And there's an infinite amount of things to defend yourself. And the problem is, I'm not God. And I don't have the capacity to do it. It's like going into the kitchen and getting the blender that's designed for 110 volts and taking it into your laundry room and plugging it in the outlet for the dryer that's 220. It will burn it out. It does not have the capacity to handle the load, and neither do I. That's why I need God. That's why when new guys say, "How you doing?" and they say, "It's too big," I know exactly what they're saying. It's too big. That's why if you're dry and you're running the universe and defending yourself and trying to protect yourself and make yourself happy, after a period of time, you start looking tired. It's too much. It's too big. Self-reliance failed me. And the answer, it says, is to trust God. I was at a retreat, it'll be about a year and a half sober, and I've been saying the third step prayer every morning, and I tell you, I'm going crazy. I say the third step prayer, I get off my knees, and 15 minutes later, I'm anxious and uptight, and I'm worried, and I'm running the conversations in my head about what's going to happen when I get to work, and I'm full of anxiety. And I'm sitting at this retreat, sitting on the lawn talking to this old guy, and I'm telling him all this, and I said, "Man, I don't know what's wrong. This has got to change." And he says, "Well, do you believe in God?" And I said, "Oh, yeah. I really have a lot of faith in God. I'm sober longer than I've ever been. I know God did that. I didn't do that." He said, "And you pray every day, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, for people like us, you can have all the faith in the world and pray every day and still die of alcoholism. It's not enough." He said, "What we must have is something a little more deeper." He said, "We have to have trust." And I must have looked at him like I don't get it. He said, "Let me tell you the difference between faith and trust." He said, "If you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act, you'd sit there and you could watch a gentleman come out to the edge of the tight wire pushing a wheelbarrow. And you could sit in the audience and have complete and absolute faith that he could walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. I bet you'd say to yourself, you know, he's a professional. I bet you he's done it 1,000 times. I'm absolutely convinced he can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. But if you had trust, you'd get up there and get in the wheelbarrow." And when he said that, I thought, "Oh, shit. Get in the wheelbarrow? No. I don't want to get in the wheelbarrow. I want to talk about getting in the wheelbarrow. I want to read about getting in the wheelbarrow. I want to go to meetings and discuss getting in the wheelbarrow, but I don't want to get in the wheelbarrow. I'm afraid. See, I'm afraid that I'll get in God's wheelbarrow. We'll get about halfway out that wire, and God's going to look and say, is that Bob? Is that little sumbitch did that to his mom and dad? Is that that guy? Is that that little guy used to play with it? But is that Bob?" Right? I don't trust God. And yet my very life depends upon me trusting God. Why? If I learn nothing else from the inventory, I must learn that I can't trust me. That self-reliance has failed me. I am forced through a lack of alternatives towards God reliance. There's just nothing else to do. There's nowhere to go. I am forced to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and it can't be hypothetical. I'm the guy that has to get in the wheelbarrow. I was just having a conversation about a year ago with a guy that I sponsored sober a long time. He's 18 now, he's 17 in. And he said to me, he's a mess. He said, I'm just crazy. I'm getting in beefs all the time at work. I'm supposed to be the boss. I'm in trouble all the time. I'm uptight all the time. I don't know what's going on. I said, you got to surrender. He says, I knew you were going to say that. I know. He says, but I'm 17 years in AA. I get that. He says, what I want to know is how the hell do you do that? How do you do that? I can say the words. I get it intellectually that I'm supposed to do it. How do you actually surrender? I told him what I believed to be true. I said, you must develop a vision of how a surrendered person would act and act like that. And he got it. He said, you know, a surrendered guy is not going to get in beefs with these guys because he's going with the flow. He's just there to be of service. He's not there to control. I said, that's right. A surrendered guy is a guy who's showing up just trying to help God's kids and trying to be of service to his boss. He doesn't have to control or defend against nothing. And he started trying to act like a vision that he developed of what a surrendered person would act like. And just in the last year, they just had a big party for him. All the people that he was at odds with just had a big party for him at the job and gave through this for his birthday and just all this. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. Because self-reliance was failing him. If it would have worked, if self-reliance worked, AA would be giving workshops on how to better run your life. But AA only talks about one thing, how to let go of your life. See, because I fail at life itself. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It is my greatest virtue is my failure. My not enoughness is the greatest thing I have going for me. And often in AA meetings, people will talk bad about our inadequacies as if you're supposed to overcome them. This feeling of not enoughness, you're supposed to outgrow it. No, I'm not. It is my greatest virtue. My not enoughness and my inadequacy is what brings me to the table with God. If I tell you something, if I was enough, screw God, screw you, screw my sponsor. I'm going to go do my life. My failure and inadequacy and inability to run my life is the greatest virtue I have. It's what brings me to the table. Or else, why would I come to this party? I wouldn't come to this party. Except I don't have a choice. My failure becomes my greatest asset. Just as we are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon God or depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him, it's a prayer, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And if I will do that, it says at once, I will commence to outgrow fear. Never, I don't think, to get completely removed from it, but I will outgrow it. You know what outgrowing fear means to me? Is that I keep enough courage to keep one step in front of it to keep moving forward. There was a time in my life when fear overwhelmed me. It kept me on the sofa. I couldn't get off the sofa. I outgrow fear just to the extent that it's still there. It's still a gnawing force that chases me around. It is part of my inclination to be afraid. It comes with the territory of being inclined towards self-involvement. But I stay one step ahead of it, and one step in God's direction, and not back there. Not back there. And what it talks about in this paragraph, rather than making me fearless, it talks about getting courage, the courage to walk through the fear, the courage to show up when I'm scared and face people when I've screwed up and say, you know, I was wrong. The courage to show up for my own life. The courage not to believe my head when my head says, don't go over there. You're not going to like that. It's going to be bad. They don't like you. They're against you. Don't even go over there. And I'll say, thank you for sharing, and go anyway. And once again, prove my head wrong. I wonder how many times I got to prove my head wrong before my head just quits. You know, how many thousands of times my head tells me, you're not going to like this, it's going to be awful, it's terrible, don't do this, they don't like you, they're against you, don't do it. And I go through it, I walk through it, and it's not like that at all. When is my head going to go, all right, I'm going to leave you alone? It won't leave me alone. It always shows up, and it always has an opinion, and it always wants to tell me how this is going to be awful. I don't know about your head. My head never projects good stuff. I never wake up in the morning and it says to me, oh, Bob, they're going to love you today. Oh, Bob, they're just waiting to have you part of their life. Stay. It never says that to me. It says, you know what they're thinking about you? You know, it says all that hideous stuff to me. And it's wrong. It's wrong. All the time. It's wrong. Thank God it's wrong. At once we commenced to outgrow fear. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind, whatever that means. I never get that. I want pictures. I don't know what they mean. I don't know. There's two schools of thought and everything in AA and everything in between. And the world's like that. I remember this. I don't know if you guys were around. When I was a kid, in the late 60s, early 70s, the free love thing, where people were so open with sex that huge communes of 30, 40 people would all have sex with each other all the time. And it was just sex, 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 sex. Everybody had sex with everything. And they thought that was great. And then I grew up in a childhood where sex was like, with very religious, and sex was evil, and it probably came from Satan, and it was dirty and disgusting, and you only did it in the dark with someone you love, which will put a spin on your personality in relationships if you come from that place. And you have both extremes. Both extremes. And we have both extremes in AA. We have everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that's in the human race, probably in capital letters. We have the people that come in here that have spent a whole life of trying, that really had so many problems with sex that they couldn't even try it until they were drunk out of their mind, because they were so full of fear and shame and inadequacy. And then there are other people that were so much the other way, you wouldn't even want to leave them alone with your poodle. Jesus. You know, and we have everything in between. Everything on the spectrum of sexuality we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. We're no different than any other society. And that one of the amazing things is that the way the book treats this, it's so sensible and down to earth. It says, we want to stay out of this controversy. This is an outside issue of what kind of sex is right and what kind's not. What's your level of promiscuity or sexual involvement or frequency is none of our business. Who you have sex with is none of our business. It says we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Well, if that's true, God, what are we going to talk about at Denny's now? Jesus, guys, it's all, you go to Denny's with a bunch of alcoholics, you know who's sleeping with them? I mean, that's all they do. You know, it's just crazy. I stay out of that stuff. I really try. I tell the guys I sponsor, stop that. Stop it. Stop it. You sound like an old lady. You know, gossip. Stop it. We're not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And that's great news for most of us, because I've never met an alcoholic yet that didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and no matter where they were on the spectrum of sexuality, not feel ashamed of themselves. And the people who almost had no sex because they were so afraid, and the one or two times they had sex and they had to be extremely drunk to do it, feel very ashamed of themselves for being that way, as if there's something wrong with them. Just as much as the person who had their sexual encounter list is 7 pages long because they just went from one partner to another, to another, to another, indiscriminately, like this human instant gratification monster that just went through life. And he feels just as ashamed of his sexuality and his sexual experiences as the person who had virtually no sex at all. I don't know anybody that ever came to AA, and if they really got honest about their own sexuality, really felt that it was all right. It really felt that it was just, you know, I was just the way I was supposed to be. I mean, you may say that, but most of us feel really damaged in that area. And I think the great blessing of this stance that we take of refusing to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct is I think most of us have this tremendous fear that we came here, if I was really to be transparent with you in the areas of sex and romance, that you're not going to accept me, that I am going to be too flawed, too pathetic, too deviant, too backward, too inhibited, too something. And so when we come here and we find out, hey, whatever you are, it's fine. This is not about that. The questions we are going to inventory in the sexual inventory are not about frequency or method or equipment or any of that stuff. It's not about any of that. It's about selfishness. It's about fear. It's about dishonesty. It's about inconsideration. It's about driven by self and hurting other people in the process. It's not about sex is not the problem. It's self-centered behavior that causes the problem. Sex is not the issue. Unfortunately, sometimes we use sex like a weapon and people get hurt. But it's not from the sex that they get hurt. They get hurt from the selfishness and the self-centeredness and the fear and the dishonesty. We reviewed our conduct over the years past. So once again, I'm making a list. Where had I been selfish in my sexual encounters and relationships? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where was I at fault? What should I have done better? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. I'll tell you what I discovered. I asked myself, when I made the list of all my sexual relationships and encounters, and I started asking these questions, when I asked myself in all the questions where I'd have been selfish, what became very apparent is that there was selfishness in every single one of them without exception. And whether I was conscious of it or not, if I peeled away the layers of the onion, what I discovered, I was a me-first person. I may dress it up and look altruistic and look loving and affectionate. I may let you finish first. I may all that stuff to hide behind the screen that it's all about me. It's all about my not wanting to be alone. It's all about my need for a partner. It's all about my need for sexual gratification, for emotional support. It's all about me. very selfish and dishonest. Oh, God. That's the problem with most. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I tell you, every time there's a problem in a relationship, it's not every time. A lot of times, it seems to come from dishonesty where the harm is done. And I think that we have an ability as alcoholics in relationships to be dishonest at a pathological, delusional level more than any other area of our life. And I think the reason is, the reason is that Bill in the 12 by 12 talks about the three basic instincts that drive us: the instinct for sex, the instinct for security, both emotional and material, and the instinct for a place in society. And sexual relationships and partnerships is the only area where all three of those basic instincts can be affected or threatened in the level that they can be in those relationships. You won't get threatened in all those three areas like you will on the job, unless you're sleeping with your boss, maybe. But in relationships, all three of those areas. And so the greater the potential for exposure and fear, the greater the potential for defense. And the greater for the potential for defense, the more self-will, the more dishonesty. I have lied a lot in my life, but I'm going to tell you, I never lied because I'm a liar. I lied because I was afraid. I was afraid of rejection. I was afraid of what you'd think of me. I was afraid you'd leave me. I was afraid of not being enough. That's why I lie. And because there's a greater propensity for fear in relationships, there's a greater capacity for dishonesty. One of the things that a lot of us do, that especially if you got sober single, or maybe after you were sober for a while, you got single, and you have to go through the dating thing sober. It's hideous. It's hideous. And what happens, and what it's very common, I found myself doing this in early sobriety for a number of years, and is that in my need to be loved and accepted, I still buy the old lie. And the old lie is, if you really knew me as is, you wouldn't really love me. So what happens is I start dating someone and I create this facade, this super Bob, you know, persona that I put out there. And I kind of, all the stuff that could be questionable about Bob, I lock in a closet somewhere. Now that's Bob too, but I lock away in the closet, and we're not going to bring this Bob to the date. We're going to bring Super Bob. And Bob, Super Bob is wonderful, and he's never has a discouraging word, and he's right, and the skies are cloudy all day, you know, that kind of, right? He's a great guy. The problem is when you're like that, you're writing checks you can't cash. And the problem is there always comes a day where you can't be that way anymore, and then the other guy comes up. And how many times the guys that I sponsor, they'll come up to me and they'll be insane. And they'll tell me these stories about the girl they're married to and all how they've all of a sudden changed. And they haven't changed. That's the girl you married in the first place. She's just never let you see that. All right? And the problem with that is that every time I do that, I reinforce the lie that you see. And then what happens, the real me comes out. And you get disillusioned and hurt, and you feel lied to, and you can't trust me, and you reject me. And the little voice in my head says, see, when they find out who you really are, nobody's going to love you. And I get to be right again. And every time I lie, about, I put the facade out, I reinforce the secret belief that as is, I'm not enough. And I'll tell you, sometime in your life, you got to get to a place or you'll be who you are. And if you're loved as is, then you're really loved. And if you don't love me as is, you're not the person I'm looking for. Because if I have to be something I'm not for your approval, I would rather be alone. I can't lose myself again like that. I can't do it. I've done that. Can't do that no more. I was married to a gal. She's a sweet girl. We got divorced at the end of the year. And she wanted to be married to me so badly that she created a persona. Not because she's a bad person. She's just afraid. She's afraid that I probably wouldn't marry her if I knew the truth. When I ask her about debt, and do you have any credit card debts? You ever had a bankruptcy? Do you ever have anything? Oh, no, I don't believe in it. She'd heard me tell a guy that I sponsor one day about, don't ever carry a balance on those credit cards. That's terrible interest. Don't use it if you can't pay it off. And she heard me say that. So she said the same, parroted the same thing back to me. No, I never have had credit card debt. I don't ever do that stuff. And boy, if that was only true. And then we get married. The bankruptcies start showing up. The $40,000 in debt. The spending addiction. The inability. And then the massive fear. As the stuff starts coming to the surface, she has to start stealing to cover it up so she doesn't get caught in the lie. And it snowballed and snowballed and snowballed, trying to put this stuff to rest before it catches up with her. And she was chairman of a roundup, and she stole $15,000 from them trying to cover up some stuff over here, and then stole money from me to cover up some stuff over there because they were catching her. And it's going crazy, and she can't help it. And she's not a bad person. She's just a person like me that I know I could get caught up in that stuff, running on self-will and just spin out of control. And in the whole process, thinking that I'm protecting myself, I'm defending myself. One of my friends, a pilot, he tells a great story about when the first time he ever soloed and he went out in this plane, he has a pilot with him and he's at the stick by himself and he goes into a tailspin. And he said in the tailspin, everything in him, he's heading for the ground. He's going to die. And the guy with him is yelling, "Let go of the stick." And he's like, "I can't let go of the stick." He's pulling it back because he's got to pull that plane up. And the pulling back on the stick feeds the tailspin. And the guy finally pushes him away from the stick and knocks it out of his hand and yells at him, "Leave it alone." And he lets go of the stick and the plane just straightens right out and flies. Because they're designed to do that. But every instinct in him was to pull back to save his life. I know about those kind of fears. I know about that kind of self-centeredness. I know about that kind of self-destruction. I know about my own inability to manage my own life. And that's where the dishonesty comes from. It's not because I'm a dishonest guy. I'm afraid. I'm scared and I'm frantically trying to protect me. And I don't know an alcoholic that hasn't done that or is not capable. In him was to pull back to save his life. I know about those kind of fears. I know about that kind of self-centeredness. I know about that kind of self-destruction. I know about my own inability to manage my own life. And that's where the dishonesty comes from. It's not because I'm a dishonest guy. I'm afraid. I'm scared and I'm frantically trying to protect me. And I don't know an alcoholic that hasn't done that or is not capable of doing that. But it makes it hard to live with someone who's in the middle of that. I don't make a good Al-Anon. I just don't. Steal from me and lie to me 3-4 times. And I forgive you, good at it, forgive. And then once I get it that this ain't going away and this is going to be a lifetime of jumping through these hoops, I'm out of here. I'm not a good Al-Anon. I listen to the Al-Anon stories of the women who put up with that stuff for